Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Just 2 weeks ago, the United Nations released a report that made headlines around the globe. The report, compiled by nearly 150 authors from 50 nations over 3 years, shows us a planet in crisis. 1 million plant and animal species on the verge of extinction, and serious implications for the health and the survival of our species. Jim Pease is an emeritus associate professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University, and he is here with us today to help us understand what this means for our planet and for all of us. Jim, these headlines made a big splash everywhere. We saw it in every publication. We heard it on the radio. We saw it all over television. And honestly, one of my first reactions to the report was that it wasn't necessarily new news. I mean, I feel like we've been talking about this. Some of us have been talking about it. People have been studying it and writing about it for a number of years. What was your reaction?
Yeah, I had some of the same reaction. I felt that it was good that it was getting that kind of coverage, both nationally and internationally, and that was a very good thing. But it's not news in that sense. To people who've been paying attention. It's the kind of thing, perhaps not at that, we haven't added them all up, but I think botanists talk about plants that are in danger, and those of us in the wildlife side talk about wildlife that are having problems. And we perhaps have never added them all up, but this whole concept of a million species is really impressive, and that seems to be what grabbed the attention of a lot of people. I think there are some other things in this report that also jump out, but that's one I think that people especially looked at. We've been talking about this. I think I've been on this program now, Charity, for 30 years.
Yes.
And I think we've been talking about species ever since the beginning of that. So it's been going on a long time, and certainly since the passage of the Endangered Species Act in the U.S. and some similar acts in a few other foreign countries or other countries around the world, I think people have been aware of this, and certainly in academia there is. But the knowledge of the broader population, perhaps, when they see it, that number, a million species, that says something, and that's good. I'm glad that it got that kind of that kind of publicity.
Absolutely. I mean, it definitely got a lot of attention. Of course, we know how our news cycle is. So let's dig into this and keep this conversation alive today. You have not just read all of the newspaper articles and all of the stuff that the
coverage,
rest of us has
right.
read.
Right.
You've dug into the report, which is not an easy read.
No, and this is just the summary, if you will, when it finally comes out, when the final report comes out, and that will be sometime, I believe, this year yet. It will be a dense report, and looking at the figures and everything, there's a lot of density in this as it goes. But so I want to kind of boil it down for folks to try to make some sense of it so that they don't get too overwhelmed by it. And I think you have put this on the IPR, the complete summary.
We will when we post this show later today.
Okay, on the IPR website. And it's called the Global Assessment Report on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. And I think the two of those things are really important to think about. So there were four key messages in here. One, the first one being, and this is the one that got a lot of attention, I would say most of the attention from most people looking at the report. Perhaps it was because it was first, I'm not sure. People, I don't know if they read farther or not. But it says, nature and its vital contributions to people are deteriorating worldwide. And that to me was really, really important because it made that that intimate connection that ecologists and philosophers and others have made for a long time, talking about the important link between human health and well-being and that of the Earth as a whole, the ecosystems, the other species with whom we share this Earth, that if they're not doing well, if the Earth isn't doing well, it's a pretty good chance we won't do well either. And this is where this million species, this is, excuse me, this is the section where the million species of being endangered is coming up. So they're talking about here not just the species, but ecosystem functions and services as well. And this is the, I think one of the most important things to realize. And again, we've talked about this on the show in terms of if we just look at our own state and the changes we have made to the landscape. We talk about Iowa being the altered state, and that would be a good slogan for our license plates, perhaps. And it's not a value judgment. It's just saying we have changed more of this landscape than perhaps any other state in the union. And so there's relatively small amounts of wild land and wild places left. We found a lot of those wild places and protected a lot of them, but there isn't a lot left. And I was surprised to see the figure in the report that there was 70% or 75% of the land across the globe has been altered for human use. That was surprising to me. I think in Iowa, in terms of 98-99% has been altered for human uses. But I thought across the globe, it's not that much. But it has been, apparently, according to this report, talking 3/4 of the land base across the world has been significantly altered for human crops, for human use.
Which is incredibly striking because when you think about some of the wide open places around the globe, I think that just drives home that the places where there are densely populated cities, where there are more people, how radically altered our environment is.
Yeah, yeah. And that impacts the habitats certainly that are available to various wild species, plants and animals, and it alters the function of the ecosystems. And when they talk about ecosystem services, this seems to be a fairly dense concept for lots of things. But if we look at it in terms of the kinds of things that forests, wetlands, prairies, and rivers do for us, the services they provide, then maybe it makes more sense. We call them ecosystem services, but it's like, okay, well, what do they provide us other than the soil in which to grow our crops, which is no small deal, the wood with which to build homes and businesses, the raw materials that we use for roads, for building all the infrastructure needs that we have, but also the other ecosystem services that forests provide, things like oxygen, plants providing oxygen for us to breathe, and large forests providing terrific, an amazing amount of storage capacity for carbon. Wetlands providing the kinds of services they have. Now, we have in Iowa drained, we've talked about this before in the program, somewhere between, of the original wetlands that were here back when Euro-Americans first came to Iowa, we have drained somewhere between 95 and 98% of them and converted them to other uses, including for farms, for roads, for cities and towns, businesses, etc. So we've drained those away. Well, what were the ecosystem services that they provided? Well, they provided storage capacity. When we have these big spring rains like we've been seeing recently, the wetlands provided that. They were like big sponges that that held back the water for us. They cleaned that water before it went into our waterways. They provided a way of providing lots and lots of habitat for for species that inhabited those areas. Those ecosystem services are not things that we considered, of course, when we drained them. And as a result, today we have higher floods and faster floods because we've learned how to remove water very quickly from the land. And the consequence of that is that the service of those wetlands is no longer available by draining them. So, it's those sorts of things. And this is not just in Iowa. It's not just in the U.S. It's around the world. We've altered those landscapes in a way. We're continuing to alter them.
And we think of ourselves as separate from the ecosystem.
Right.
We think of our species as separate from other species. And I found it interesting in the report, actually, the use of the language, which I know is scientific, but thinking about ecosystem services also puts it in economic terms.
Right.
And that's something that we, just the way we think about our lives and our planet and our resources, we don't put monetary value on ecosystem services.
Yeah, in fact, later on in the report, they talk about internalizing the externalities. And what that means is taking account of those kinds of things that the environment provides for us. So that instead of, for example, accounting for the waste that we produce in the price of our products, we assume that somebody else or something else is going to handle that waste for us. Well, that's an ecosystem service that we have to include in the economics when we do these economic forecasts. And so they're calling for, and this has been called for, quite honestly, for quite some time, to include those costs, those long-term costs of a technology, of a new process, include those ecosystem costs in the cost of the product that you're buying.
Jim, we're going to need to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Jim Pease is an Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. Today, we're talking about the implications of a report, at least the preliminary report released by the United Nations that tells us that 1 million plant and animal species are on the verge of extinction.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. 2 weeks ago, the headlines were everywhere about a United Nations report that was released, compiled by nearly 150 authors from 50 nations over 3 years. 1 million plant and animal species are on the verge of extinction, and there are serious implications for the health and survival of our own species. Jim Pease is an Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. We're talking about the implications of this report. Jim is helping us translate it into language we can understand and also go beyond those headlines that all of us read a couple of weeks ago, terrifying headlines, to really understand what we need to take away from this report. So we've talked about this finding that we have altered the landscape, 75% of the landscape across this globe. We've talked about how we need to take into account our connection to the ecosystem as we see these animals and plants disappearing quickly, what that means for humans. What else do we need to be taking away from this report?
Well, one of the things that they talk about, particularly under this key message of contributions to of nature to people, is that the loss of species is not just in wild species, but there's a big section on the implications for growing food. Because it talks about since the 1970s, in the last 50 years, in agricultural production, fish harvest, bioenergy production, there have been increases in all of those areas. We've gotten better at ag production. We harvested more fish. We're using more bioenergy than ever before. But in 14 of the 18 categories of contributions to nature, most of them were declining. And this includes a real worry about the amount of decline in soil quality for growing food across the world. They're talking about a 23% of the global terrestrial area has reduced productivity over that 50-year period. So while we may see increases here in Iowa, that's not true across the globe, even across the U.S. And they talk about the loss of species that we grow to eat. Something like 70% of the plants that we grow for food, of the species of plants, not the total production, but of the species of plants we grow for food, are insect pollinated, or pollinated by mostly by insects, but also by some mammals, bats, and other things as well. And those are in decline. Now, that's a real worry. There's been a lot of emphasis in the last couple of years about pollinator plots and such things in the state and around the nation, particularly in regards to monarchs. But it's not just monarchs that are in decline. We're seeing that across a whole lot of very, very important bee species and other, and as well as butterfly species and others that are actually important in pollination. And we don't always know the reason for those declines. As a beekeeper, we're still struggling with the huge losses in bees from year to year in honeybee populations. So we see it in other wild insect populations. So there's a real, it's not just wild species that are being reduced, but they're a plant and animal, but it's also even the domesticated ones. We're using fewer and fewer varieties. What does that mean for us? Well, both in terms of wild species and in terms of domesticated species, the problem is that it reduces our options for the future. Because when you lose a species, you're losing all of the genetics that led up to that species. And I see that genetic diversity, as well as species diversity, as giving us options for the future, for an unknown future that we don't we won't have if that species goes extinct, and that includes both on the domestic production and with wild species as well, plants and animals. So we're losing that genetic diversity as well, and that's a real problem. So a million species basically is about 25% of all the plants and animals on Earth. That's a huge loss. That's a huge loss.
Absolutely. We're talking about this recent report released from the United Nations and some of the key findings of that report. Now, again, that's what was grabbing the headlines, Jim,
right. Yeah.
the million species, which is terrifying,
yeah.
and stark. Let's go beyond that. What else do we need to know about?
Yeah, another of the key messages was that what they call direct and indirect drivers of change have accelerated during the past half century, the last 50 years. And so this rate of change in nature has been really unprecedented in all of human history. So it's really not just the direction of change, but also the rate of change has changed so much. And we think about that in terms of our technology and how much the last 50 years have changed in our technology and our ability to adapt. It's true. We've been able to grow different crops and more crops and more of them and all those sorts of things. But there are other things that are accelerating right along with that technology. And they talk about some things that are five drivers of change. One is direct changes in land and sea use. And we think about that. I was talking with some of the people who went with me to the Galapagos about fisheries around the world and how fisheries, I think in part because the fish are not as, they're hidden in the water in a way. But fisheries around the world have been mismanaged for centuries. We have constantly driven various incredibly rich fisheries to the brink of extinction, and we don't seem to learn from that at all through overharvest and improved technologies at harvesting them and taking them younger and younger, et cetera, et cetera. We've driven fishery after fishery. You start with the cod fishery in the Northeast and anywhere around the world. It's not just us. It's everybody. They tend to drive fish stocks into extinction. So changes in the sea use, changes in land use, is one of those direct drivers of change. Direct exploitation of organisms, more use of species that we didn't used to use at all, and then it applies especially to the sea, but also on land, and over harvest of things that would be sustainable if we were more careful. Thirdly,
so our technology allows us to be more efficient.
Yes. Or effective. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so, of course, we think about how these are advances, but not necessarily about the damage that that efficiency can do.
Right. Right. And we don't think beyond to future generations. We think about how successful we are, not about how successful our ancestors might also need to be. So, third of the five drivers is climate change. I was kind of surprised that wasn't first, but it wasn't. They said climate change is one of, and we know this from research after research after research paper that climate change is driving a whole lot of things, and we see this not so much in the temperate zones of the world, but actually more so in the tropics, the subtropics, and in the Arctic. At the extremes of our world, along the equator and at the poles, we see climate change moving very, very rapidly. The melting of glaciers, melting of whole ice caps in the Arctic and the Antarctic, on and on and on. So climate change is a huge driver. And whether species can adapt to rapidly enough to that climate change. Some species will be able to adapt, and those that have the most varied ways of adapting, some will adapt, but many species will not, and we'll lose. That's one of the key drivers of how many species will be lost. Fourth in this impact drivers is pollution. And I couldn't help but think about this one. If you've ever been to the seashore or been out to sea and come across the huge garbage dump that is now in the center of currents in our oceans, you realize, yep, this is real. And that's just the stuff you can see, let alone the other kinds of pollution, air pollution, et cetera, et cetera. It's a huge driver of loss of species. And then lastly, the fifth driver is the invasion of alien species. What's an alien species? These aren't from outer space. These are species that, and we have lots of them here, what we call invasive species. And we think of it in terms of primarily plants, things like in Iowa, honeysuckle, European buckthorn, garlic mustard, those sorts of things. But there are also animals that are invasive as well that come into the Great Lakes. In fact, if you paddle any of the rivers in southeastern Iowa that are directly connected to the Mississippi, you probably run into silver carp, the carp that jump over into the boat and out of the boat at disturbance. Many of our listeners have probably seen the incredible videos of fish flying as a boat drives by. I've experienced it myself, even in a kayak. Doesn't have to be a motorized. So, in invasive species, species that didn't evolve on the continent or in the country where they are now found, are impacting the native species that are left in severe enough ways that's one of the five drivers of extinction. So. The five drivers of change that are, these things have accelerated so much in the last 50 years that we're seeing these drivers really push us farther.
I want to take a moment as we think about these invasive species, because, again, we've talked about them quite a bit on Talk of Iowa. And if you are involved in conservation in Iowa, you've had many conversations about invasive species. And conservationists around the state, individuals around the state, combat these invasive species in their environment, on their property,
right,
on their acreages, and in some of our public land as well. But I was having a conversation with somebody who works in conservation recently about how we in Iowa react to invasive species, where we see honeysuckle encroaching, growing at such a rate that it blocks out native species and having a significant impact on our ecosystem. We haven't taken steps, our state government hasn't taken steps to try to control that specific invasive species, although many individuals combat it. But when we have an invasive species that affects the bottom line in agriculture, we
right.
do act. We act very quickly. So let's talk about the economics
yeah.
again. You know, we do seem to have this disconnect between things that are happening in our environment that affect us, that affect the ecosystem that we are connected to, but not caring nearly as much about that as we do if they affect someone's bottom line.
Yeah. And I think the reason is because in agriculture, you see the impact immediately, whereas in the wild, you don't see that impact maybe for several years. It's a delayed impact that you don't notice it unless you're out in the woods every day, like many of us are. Then or out in the fields, you don't necessarily see that impact. But in agriculture, in our economic system, be it agriculture or something else, we see that impact almost immediately with invasive diseases that or pathogens that come from somewhere else. We see that impact. Animals die. Plants die. We see that impact very quickly. And so that you're right. It's an economic, but I think it's not just economics. It's also that delay that we don't necessarily see the insidiousness of this invasive species until it's really a big deal. Honeysuckle is one of those things. Another one is garlic mustard. Garlic mustard as a plant is really awful in our woodlands, and it's very hard to combat, as most invasive species are very difficult to combat. Lots and lots of people have a lot of job security just fighting, you know, invasive species. And in the fisheries realm, the same sort of thing. But you don't see that impact right away. It takes a while for it to really take hold. And there are probably lots of invasives that come here and aren't able to survive the winter or the soils or whatever, and don't take hold. So we have these big problems now that we're trying to combat, but they've been here for a long, long time. In fact, honeysuckle was being planted. It's kind of like multiflora rose in the 30s. It was touted as this living fence, sold as this living fence by universities and governments everywhere, saying this is a great thing. Well, it's
beautiful.
Yeah.
And it smells wonderful.
Right. And then it takes over whole areas, and all of a sudden you realize this is a problem. It didn't evolve here. And that's the way invasive species are. They don't evolve here.
So those of us who read these headlines a couple of weeks ago and listening to everything you shared with us so far today, Jim, I mean, this is incredibly grim. It's scary. It's
yeah.
depressing. And and a response can be to feel helpless, to say, oh, we have messed this up beyond repair. That's not what the report says. And that's
right.
not your take on it.
No, I think that there are some real positive parts of the report. One is that the positive part is that it raises our consciousness of some of the problems and what are these drivers of this change. And what it comes down to is that we are the drivers of the change. And if if we're going to not lose a million species of fellow inhabitants of this planet in the next half century or maybe less, There are some things that we can do, and the report talks about those. But it takes some very important components that we as voters, we as citizens, we as decision makers, we need to do to make sure that that we reverse direction. And it's not going to be easy, but I think there is some reason for optimism.
All right, we're going to talk more about that in a moment and about your trip to the Galapagos. I know you've been a number of times over the years and have some observations to share. Of course, you're also welcome to join our conversation with your questions, your thoughts. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He's also an emeritus associate professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Jim Pease is here with us today, an emeritus associate professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. We've been talking about some of the key findings in a preliminary report that was released by the United Nations just 2 weeks ago. It's been compiled by nearly 150 authors from 50 nations over a period of 3 years. The complete report will be released later on, but the headline that came out of this report that so many of us read is 1 million plant and animal species on the verge of extinction on our planet, and it seriously calls into question the health and survival of our species, of human beings. Jim Pease and I have been talking about this report today, and Jim, as I pointed out right before the break, I mean, the report is not entirely doom and gloom,
right?
Although a great deal of it is.
Yeah.
But it does say there is hope, but that this is our moment to act. And I want to get into that a little bit more. But why don't we talk a little bit about your recent trip to the Galapagos and some of the things that you can see in an ecosystem that has been, I guess, it's such a storied ecosystem, but also a heavily studied ecosystem.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me to read this report in that context, having just been to the Galapagos. The Galapagos are a chain of islands, volcanically derived islands, about 600 miles off the coast of Ecuador, right on the equator. That's why Ecuador is named the way it is. It's on the equator. And the islands are part of Ecuador. And because they're so far off the coast, just like the Hawaiian Islands are a volcanic set of islands in the middle of the Pacific, much farther north, they have a set of species on those islands that are peculiar. The giant tortoises come to mind, the flightless cormorants, the penguins. You have penguins on the equator? What? This is crazy. And all of those species have adapted, somehow gotten there, and we won't go into that. And they have adapted because these islands are literally starting from scratch. So when they emerge from the ocean as a volcanic island, and we got to visit and walk on some fairly new islands as a result that are still active volcanically, as well as some much older, 4 million old islands, 4 million years old, so these species have gradually evolved there. There are probably many other species that didn't survive, that couldn't survive the relatively harsh conditions, often very dry conditions, actually. There are cacti there. There are several species of cacti there. But other species have done very well. Iguanas, for example, have evolved, and it's sort of, you can see this evolution over time into both land iguanas and then a totally separate species of marine iguana, where they're actually swimming underwater and feasting on the algae below. The giant tortoises that probably weren't giant when they got to the island, the giant tortoises that gradually evolved to fit into that environment. We're talking 400 or 500 pound critters here. I mean, these are massive tortoises. So it's an unlike anything else in the world, totally separate species. So you look at that sort of speciation, and this is sort of a microcosm of, it's been studied for a long time by evolutionary biologists looking at how speciation takes place. Darwin, who of course was made famous by the Enchanted Isles and his writings about them and other people, the Darwin's finches that are exclusive to different islands in the chain. Totally different. There are 17 different species now.
Right, those finches that really helped him unlock the ideas about evolution.
Yeah, exactly. And so this was, we talked a lot about, for example, climate change there. The islands are being on the equator are very much affected by some of the big ocean currents that affected in so many ways. But and we've talked about this here in Iowa, the impact of El Nino and La Nina, which are certain weather systems that come out of the Pacific and how they impact our weather here in the central part of North America. You can imagine in the tropics, they're even more affected. And what happens is, what has happened in our lifetimes in the 1990s was the most recent one where they had a very strong El Nino, and it warmed the waters to such an effect that they had a massive die-off of several things, but in part a massive die-off of marine iguanas. And the iguanas that remained that survived were much smaller, and have maintained that stature to the present day. Even though they recovered, why did they die? Because the waters were too warm it killed the algae that they needed in the waters to survive. That was an immediate impact on their population and on the populations of sea lions, of Galapagos sea lions, which are related they came down on the currents from the California sea lion populations probably and evolved a separate species over time. They also, their populations were also decimated because the species which they feed on couldn't survive in those warm waters. So are these chain reaction impacts across the food web, which is fairly simple in the Galapagos, and we look at those chain reactions, the possibilities in other ecosystems, including our own. When we look at crops that are needing to be, that we depend on, that have to be pollinated by insects, if we don't have those insects around anymore, how do we make sure that those crops get pollinated?
So by looking at the Galapagos, which has an ecosystem that's easy to study. You can see the immediate results.
Exactly.
Those impacts, of course, are taking place globally, but they're not as visible.
Not as visible to us because, in part because the systems are more, the food webs, for example, are more complex. I talked once, I think before on this program, about my master's research on snowshoe hares in northern Alberta, and the lesson of that, it seemed rather esoteric at the time, but I've talked to people a lot about it since, and people say, well, how does that apply to humans? And I said, well, the lesson in the snowshoe hare populations and perhaps in us, is that these hares over and over and over, about every 10 years, outbreed themselves, outbreed their food supply, and they crash in population. They recover, but they crash in population, going from about 10 hares per acre down to one hare per 10 acres. So, you know, a couple of orders of magnitude. And I said, that's a lesson. That a species under natural conditions can destroy its own environment. I said that ought to be a lesson for us, and I think that it's a similar sort of thing. We can see on a small scale, like the Galapagos, which is a pretty simple system, or in snowshoe hares in northern Alberta, which is also a fairly simple system. We see the impacts when we. When things change to the point where you have too much population or too warm a water or whatever it might be, the species crash. And I think that we ought to take a lesson from nature and see ourselves in it rather than apart from it.
So in thinking again about the future, when we look at this last century of incredible technological advances, we have so many incredible examples of human ingenuity, things that really didn't seem like they could be done, but have been done because our species is pretty extraordinary.
Right.
However, most of those incredible innovations have been done for economic gain. How do we harness this ingenuity that we have to reverse what's happening to our planet and our species?
Yeah, and that's the last part of the report. The third key message was that this isn't the first report that's come out like this. There have been other agreements that have been reached through the UN, and the third point talks about how we're not going to reach the goals in those other agreements if we continue at the same pace. It includes the Paris Agreement on climate change and a biodiversity target and the Agenda for Sustainable Development and a whole bunch of other reports that have come before this. And the fourth key message in this is that it can happen. We can change directions, but it's going to take what they call transformative change. And for me, that says we need transformative leaders. We've got to have, we're not going to do this, we can do only do so much on our own as a country and as a world. And it talks about embracing diversity, seeing diversity not only in nature as a strength, but in ourselves, in our peoples, and in our countries. And embracing diversity in such a way because that gives us strength. And if we look at natural systems, diversity is strength. And I think it can be the same if we look at it that way. We see nationally and internationally trends in the opposite direction. We see these sort of nationalist and protectionist policies that are emerging, not just here, but around the world. And that's taking us in the opposite direction. Instead of embracing diversity, it's saying, no, 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 we're going to pull in and be independent. This is saying, this report shows, I think, how much we are interconnected around the world, and we have to make decisions on a UN, a united basis, rather than a separate basis. We look at current trends here in the U.S. and even in the state of undoing environmental regulations, of basically tying the hands of regulators and our environmental folks that are trying to enforce environmental laws that we've passed in the past. And that's a trend in the opposite direction. It says, nope, we gotta figure out how to transform ourselves so that we see that it's in our best economic, political, social, and existence, that it's in our best interest in all those areas to make the changes so that these species don't go extinct, and so that we learn how to reduce total consumption, we control our populations, reduce inequalities in our societies, because those impact. It's interesting to me that there are clearly some sociologists as well as ecologists and biologists on these writers, because they see the human impact of resource depletion on societies. And that's a very tough thing for a lot of us biologists to see. We see this impact on other species, and sometimes we don't see it on ourselves. And so this report, I think, really talks about unleashing those values, human values, and making sure that there's environmental justice involved in our rules and that sort of thing. But these are all, it's going to take cooperative action, not individual action. It's going to have to take some incentives, probably. But we're going to have to make some really tough decisions. Change is hard. it's really hard. We all know that. And when we think about changing the direction of the world, that's even harder, you know. But so it's going to take some real leaders make sure that as a society, not everybody's going to be happy, but we're going to have to make some decisions that are really, really tough if we're going to reverse this.
Jim, you've been working in conservation for your entire lifetime,
right?
Basically. You've seen a lot of changes, a lot of things that are not very pretty, but you've also seen some really positive changes over the years, and you tend to be a pretty optimistic guy.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. I mean, it's hard to read this stuff without being really pessimistic, without feeling like it's too late, and without losing some faith in our species and our ability to respond to this. How are you feeling?
Yeah, well, as we said in the beginning of this broadcast, these aren't new. We've all known this. Those of us who've paid attention, particularly in the wildlife field, have known this for a long time, that species are decreasing in abundance and in many cases, and particularly the most vulnerable species. And species are in real trouble around the world. And having had the wonderful opportunities to travel so much of the world and see so much biodiversity around the world, I've especially been aware of it. But I've also been, I guess I'm heartened by not just reports by this like this, but when I meet people that in the Galapagos, we saw how the management of that area. Yeah, there are some politics involved that probably there's some things happening that I would like to see be done differently. But by and large, it is an incredible improvement over what was happening in the Galapagos Islands prior to the Ecuadorian government taking it over as a national park and saying, we're going to manage this in a positive way so that it's here for the future. Yep, it's a cash cow for them. There's no question. There are lots of tourist dollars that come into that nation as a result. But it's more than that. And I think they truly value that diversity. We have to see our own systems that same way. And I've been fortunate enough to see around the world there are people who really, truly care. And we just have to make sure that those folks vote, that they become our leaders, that they... And we support them when we want to make transformative change, as this report calls for. Change is not easy, and we've got to help people learn together. As an educator, you're right. I'm sort of a perennial optimist. Educators have to be that. And I think if we can absorb the lessons of this report, we can make those changes if we try.
Jim Pease, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jim Pease, an Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. He comes by every couple of months, usually to talk about the wild creatures and wild places in our state. And, of course, we'll be doing a lot more of that in the future. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.